Today is February 23rd, 2012. My name is Marcus Haslam.
I'm Adrian Sourbeer.
And I'm Carol French.
So, Carol French, when and where were you born, and when and how did you come to Portland?
I was born in Sheraton, Iowa, in 1941, August 13th, 1941. I grew up in Iowa. I moved to Portland in 1981 with my two sons and my three cats. When and how? Mm-hmm. Well, the how was in a U-Haul truck towing my pickup truck behind me with my kids and cats in the truck with me. And I came out here for a variety of reasons. My parents were retiring and moving to Arizona from Iowa, and I knew I didn't want to live in Phoenix. So, and I had been out here the year before on vacation and thought it was beautiful. So that and some other reasons. And so I left a really good teaching job back there and just packed everything up, and out I came.
Awesome. Why did you start working with the elderly gay people?
Well, it was kind of by accident. I spent my career was in public education in high school for the most part. A couple years in seventh grade, way back when I started, and got out of middle school pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And I taught college for a couple years. The rest of it was in high school. I was an English teacher, and then I was a guidance counselor out here. So I finished my career in the Evergreen District in Vancouver as a guidance counselor, and my partner, April, we've been together, it'll be 25 years this April, and she was the diversity manager for Multnomah County at the time, and she was involved in a project called, they named it, it had a different name, but they had renamed it the Elder Resource Alliance, and it was through a collaboration between Friendly House and Multnomah County, and they basically had as one of their missions to educate people who worked with the elderly about the special issues of the GLBT aging population. So they contracted with a group out of Seattle to come down and do a weekend training. And I was still working at Evergreen High School in Vancouver. And so she was going to be going through this weekend training. And I thought, well, what the heck? You know, she's in this training all weekend. I might as well take it too. So I did. I went through the training. And basically what happened was I got involved as a facilitator to facilitate this training, but I was still working, and so my involvement was somewhat limited by my schedule at work. But then I retired in 2004. So from that point on, I just became their primary facilitator and really one of the driving forces behind the training that we did in the Elder Resource Alliance, which has now been renamed Gay and Gray. Because of my experience in, you know, many years' experience in the classroom, I'm very comfortable getting up in front of groups of folks and, you know, talking, training, whatever. It can be 10 people or 100 people. I'm comfortable either way. So I stayed involved at that level. And, you know, the training has evolved over the years, but I have been very, very involved in that. And what I've discovered, just as sort of an addendum to that, is that a lot of the issues of the aging GLBT population overlap the issues of the GLBT youth. And I and two other counselors had been instrumental in establishing a support group for sexual minority youth in the Evergreen District. And so, you know, we dealt with that. Not for me, it was personal, certainly, but it was also professional. But what I found was that the gay kids and the gay elders had a lot of the same issues. And then there were some issues that had, you know, specifically to do with age that was different for mm-hmm. each group. So anyway,
yeah,
that's kind of the history of that.
Okay. So what kind of work do you do with Gay and Gray?
With Gay and Gray, and they have a lot of different things they do, but my involvement is exclusively with the training that they do. And we have changed the training to include an elder panel. And I can't remember when we started doing that. The original training that was given to our group by the group in Seattle did not have a panel. I had used panels a lot when I was a high school counselor. I did a lot of work training elementary teachers to deal with issues having to do with substance abuse in families and kids who came from alcoholic or drug-affected homes. I'm in recovery myself. I've been sober 29 years plus a few months, and so so I was doing a lot of that, and I would take student panels out, and these were kids who had been through treatment who were staying sober, and it was really effective, and so so we implemented that same model with the Gay and Gray, or at that time it was the Elder Resource Alliance training. So basically, what I do is facilitate the session. Let's say that you call and you want us to do something. We go in, and I'm the facilitator, and I have kind of a curriculum, although I get up in front of folks and I just kind of have it in my head and go, and you know, whatever people want to know about, we sort of, you know, I'm really able to be flexible. But we always have a panel, and it might, depending on the time frame, we might have two panelists or we might have three or four. And so that's where my involvement ends, is with the training itself. There are many other things they do having to do with social events and that kind of stuff, but I'm not involved at that level, so.
Okay. So you had mentioned that there's some challenges that youth and the elderly gay community both kind of face.
Right.
What are some that just the elderly gay community face, and what are some that they share?
Well, some that they share, I mean, being a member of the GLBT community in our culture, you know, anybody who's a member of the community has to deal with what it's like to be gay or transgendered or whatever it is in American culture. And that varies some depending on where you live and the kind of community you live in. If you live in Southeast Portland, it's way easier than if you live in Birmingham, Alabama, or whatever. I mean, I don't want to stereotype any part of the country, but the reality is that this particular community, I mean, even in the state of Oregon, Portland is much more liberal than some other areas might be. So that's a challenge no matter how old you are. There's issues of discrimination. I mean, I know, you know, again, from my experience as a counselor, how hard, I mean, high school's hard. High school's hard anyway, and if you are gay or perceived to be gay, I mean, you might not even be gay, but if you're perceived to be gay, or in the group that we had a lot of kids who were allies, kids who were questioning, a lot of times kids will say, well, I'm bisexual, and then they figure out later they're really not, and it's safer to be bisexual when you're 15 than to say that you're gay or whatever. I mean, there's this whole coming out process that everybody goes through. But if you're an ally, or if your mom or your dad is gay, or your sister, then everybody calls you a fag or whatever. I mean, that's that whole horrible thing about high school. It's not necessarily always the most warm and fuzzy place to be. It's changing, though. I mean, I have to say that the millennial generation, which you guys are members of, I would assume, no?
I'm the end of the Xers.
You're the end of the Xers, so you're older. My two sons are at the other end of the Xers. But even the Xers, but especially the millennials, and then whatever we're going to call the new kids coming up out of middle school now, are much more open and accepting than my generation was when they were that age. So it's changing. The culture is changing. But no matter what, if you're my age, which is 70, or if you're 17 and you're gay in this culture, there are things that you have to deal with. You don't get to walk down the street and hold hands with your partner. You don't get to go to the prom. You don't get to, you know, write notes back and forth. You have to deal with people's comments on the street or in the halls of the school. The law does not favor you. You know, you'll find, you know, when you get older that and start paying taxes, maybe you have already, or maybe you both have, but that there are certain benefits that go with being heterosexual and being married in this culture. You get to file your income tax in certain ways, or if I died tomorrow, my Social Security would go into a great black hole as opposed to going to my partner because, you know, we can't be legally married. I mean, there's a million things like that. Things having to do with insurance, things having to do with wills, things having to do with domestic partner benefits and that sort of thing. We live in Portland, where the city of Portland and Multnomah County both have very powerful and comprehensive non-discrimination policies. And so if you own a business where you do business with the county or the city, you are mandated to adhere to those policies, or you can't do business with them. But it's not like that everywhere. So a lot of those things overlap. For elders, you know, for teenagers, it's the whole angst of being a teenager and coming out and the you know, being victimized in the halls. And, you know, Dan Savage, bless his heart, had his Gets Better project, which was just great. I mean, he's got a national audience, and it was just a really good project for him to undertake. And, you know, he's just so out there with who he is and what he thinks and that sort of thing. For the elders, there are issues then having to do with, you know, what happens if your partner dies? You know, if you're married, you're heterosexual, your wife dies, your husband dies, everybody comes around and they bring you food and they, you know, pour you and all this kind of thing. You don't necessarily get that kind of support in your grief. there's insurance stuff, there's Social Security stuff, there's all the kinds of financial things. And let's say that you came out, you know, with me and my partner, our families are extremely supportive, both mine and hers. Everybody's great. Excuse me, but not everybody can say that. And so let's say that they couldn't say that about somebody's, you know, somebody else couldn't say about their partner's family that they're supportive and the kids weren't supportive. Okay, so that person dies, the kids come in and take everything. And it really, you know, in a lot of states, it doesn't matter what the will says. You have to be really pristine about how you set things up or you know. So you run into all kinds of problems. There was an incident here within the last year where somebody at one of the local hospitals, some gay man was not allowed to come in to his partner's hospital room and, you know, be a part of the decision. So there's all those kinds of things become a bigger issue when you're older. And, they don't care. The law doesn't care how long you've been together. You know, you can be together 50 years, but the law is the law is the law. And if a hospital, especially if there's a religious thing involved, can say, nope, sorry. So those things generally don't affect young people. Mm-hmm. So there are some differences, but does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Has gay and gray achieved what you hoped it would, and what is it that you would want that you wanted it to achieve?
Well, there's no there. My partner and I have a consulting business, and we do work as consultants. Figure eight consulting is the name of it. It has to do with the climbing, not ice skating. But the work that we do is really all about culture and how businesses or public agencies, you know, the Parks and Rec Department, we just did some work for them. We're getting ready to do something for the Department of Revenue for the city. You know, how can they create a work environment where everybody feels welcome and valued, number one, and how can they provide better customer service? And so this is the kind of work we do. And one of the things we tell people is that there's no there. There's no place where you arrive and you can say, oh, great, now I've got it, we're good. It's not like that. And with gay and gray, it's the same. There will always be, you know, we can go to a nursing home. Let's say that Legacy calls us, and we've done work with them, Gay and Gray has. And let's say we go in and we train their staff at one of their nursing homes or whatever. Well, a year later, they might have, you know, 30% of the staff might be new. And this is the other thing. There's a continuum. You know, there's people who are absolutely clueless about cultural issues. And then there are a lot of people, and, you know, my partner and I are pretty knowledgeable about this stuff, and we're pretty evolved in terms of our acceptance of difference. Or we couldn't be doing the work we're doing. But we both know that on the continuum, there's not an X point down here where we're going to be done. I'm 70 years old, and I'm still learning, and I'm still evolving. And when I deal with a group of folks, I know that they're going to teach me something always. I mean, my students were like that. I always learned stuff. So, has Gay and Gray accomplished everything that I want it to? No, because there's always a new group to be trained. There's always new people in the group that we can go back and talk to again. Or, you know, if this is the continuum, we go in and maybe people move this far, but they still have all this way to go. So that's one thing. There's always work to be done. And, you know, we run up against, you know, the gay marriage is a wedge issue in our culture, as you know. And the right wing makes sure it stays that way. I mean, they have their things. There's contraception. There's contraception, you know, birth control, abortion, gay people. I mean, these are the things that they use to rile up a certain segment of the voting population. And so, you know, it's really not exactly comforting to know that you're a member of a group that's used as a wedge issue to get people all foaming at the mouth. And so this stuff is out there fermenting and probably always will be. The reality is that the whole idea of reacting with fear, reacting to difference because of fear, is kind of a normal part of who we are as human beings. I mean, if you go back thousands of years, that was how they protected themselves in a very hostile environment. It's like, uh-oh, somebody from a different tribe or some animal that looks dangerous, that's how, you know, I'm afraid, therefore I reach for the weapon. I don't want anybody who's different coming in because we you know, if we think back when people had a life expectancy of, even in 1850 London, the life expectancy was 27. Wow. Yeah. So people had to be afraid of difference. Now, we still have that in our DNA. And so we have to sort of retrain ourselves to be okay. And we live in a world that has shrunk, you know. I mean, how easy it is to go around the world, and how many people do you know that have traveled in places like Thailand and China and India and whatnot? I mean, Africa. I have a friend that's going on a photographic safari in Africa in a couple of months. I mean, nobody did that when I was young. So yeah, there's always work to be done. We always have stuff to do. Gay and Gray, though, I have to say, has made somewhat of a name for itself in this community, and I mean Greater Portland, in terms of the work we do. People love the panel. They're powerful. You know, I go in and I set things up and I talk about the special issues, and then the panel comes and talks about what it's like to be old and gay. Or now we have two really well-spoken members of the transgender community. You know, one is a retired dentist, bright guy, was a bright woman now. And the other one, I don't know what she did before she transitioned, but she's also equally good. And so, I mean, it's like, this is gold. I mean, we have been looking for a trans person who could really boost the level of discourse in the panel, and we've got a couple people who are doing a great job of that. We actually have three. We have another fellow who's a minister and has written a book and actually known outside this area, and it's really great. So
yeah, it must have been hard to find someone who was open about talking with that with a large group of people.
Well, a lot of people are. You know, they say that the fear of public speaking is greater than the fear of death. People would rather die.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I'm that, you know, anomaly whereby I like it, you know. Yeah, put me in front of an audience and I don't shut up and I really enjoy it. It's very rare that I'm worried or afraid. If I were standing in front of 1,000 people and I'm up on a stage and they're all out there and it's sort of dark out there, and I can't, maybe then I would have a little flutter, but by and large, I like it. So, I mean, I've watched people on the panel sort of transform over time. You know, we have one woman on that is frequently on the panel now, and her first time, I thought she was going to die of a stroke right on the spot. Her first time, she was so nervous. She talked like 3 minutes. It was all she could do to choke it out. And now we can hardly shut her up. But it's, you know, it's been a couple of years she's been doing it, so. Mm-hmm. So, it's an interesting process. And this one transgendered woman, I haven't had her on the panel yet, but I think she's going to be phenomenal. I need to know more about her background. She's really, really good. So, anyway.
Yeah. Where do you hope to see Gay and Gray in the next 10 years?
Oh my God, 10 years. I'll be 80.
I won't complain. I'll be 40.
Oh, wow. Let's see. You know what, Marcus, I haven't really thought in terms of that. You know, it'd be nice if there were no need for it, mm-hmm. really. If I think about what would be the ideal vision would be, there's no need to have training about GLBT elders because everybody's equal. But I don't see that in 10 years. I don't see any, you know, I mean, really, if you think about it, if you go back and look at the civil rights movement, are we a post-racial culture now? Well, no. Everybody thought, oh, we elected Obama, and I voted for him, too, and of course I love him, and I think he's great, but are we now in a post-racial America? Heck no. And in some ways, it's worse than it was before he got elected. Because the people who are horrified that there's a black man in the White House have been very verbal for the last 3 years. So I just think that this whole idea of trying to create a culture where we get along better and don't have any need for diversity training, I don't see it happening.
Do you ever think it'll happen? Because you said you're 70, so I mean, things have obviously changed. Well,
they've changed a great deal.
Out.
Maybe. You know, maybe it will. America is so big, and we're so, I mean, if I look at, I don't know what things are like in smaller countries. Like, when I think of really progressive countries, I think of places like, say, Sweden, for example, maybe I don't really fully understand what goes on there. It's very possible. I haven't been there. I know that they have universal health care, so that makes them more progressive than we are. Or someplace like Belgium. You know, I really don't know. Countries that are smaller than we are, do they have the same numbers of difficulties with people who are different that we have in this country? I don't know. We're big, for one thing. We're powerful. We are very powerful. We have a huge footprint and presence in the world, and that's not a criticism. That's just who we are, and I'm okay with it as long as we don't abuse everybody in the process of just being who we are. But I think what it does mean is that we have lots of difference here. People come here for a lot of very understandable reasons. My ancestors, I'm not Native American, so they all came from someplace else, and probably yours did as well. So I think that people here struggle. You know, white people came in, I mean, you can trace all this, of course. You know, white people came in and said, oh, well, we're just going to take over this place. This is great. And so, of course, they hurt a lot of people over a couple hundred years in the process. And now we're trying to rectify some of that. We found new groups to scapegoat. I mean, gosh, I don't know. Maybe it is built in. I don't really know, you know. Maybe it's built into our DNA. Maybe not. I don't know. There's still work for me to do. That's all. It keeps me busy. It keeps me thinking and reading. I like it because I don't, mm-hmm. you know, I'm one of those people who's never bored. I've always got something that I'm interested in or I'm reading or I'm wanting to do, so.
Mm-hmm. If there's one message that you could convey to the world about the elderly gay community, what would it be?
One message?
Mm-hmm. You can choose multiple messages.
Well, you know, when I that's interesting because when I think about, you know, I get really annoyed sometimes with some of the stuff that, I mean, my partner and I, we'll celebrate 25 years in April. And we are just so normal. We're so normal, you know? She has a huge family. She's the oldest, originally six kids, but then there's been some second marriages and additional kids come in kind of thing. So she's the oldest of, really, if I count her stepbrother, Jordan, I guess it would be the oldest of, let's see. If I count her stepbrother, her dad remarried, then she would be the oldest of 10. And he should be counted because he was just a kid when he became her stepbrother. So she's the oldest of 10. I'm the oldest of three. My brother's in Iowa. My sister's in Arizona. My parents are gone. Hers are both living. Mom at the beach. Dad out in Boring. Don't you ever wonder why they named a town Boring? And I have two sons. They both live in Portland. Three grandkids. Our twin grandchildren are 8. They're in second grade. Our little grandson, Rudy, will be 3 in April, and he's fabulous. So we have this huge swirl around us all the time. We're both in recovery. Neither of us drink. We don't smoke. We eat healthy. We exercise. We pay our taxes. We're grateful that we live here. We vote in every election. We're so normal. Our families support us. We're extremely supportive of our family. People can call us and need something, and we're right there. You know, we take care of the grandkids, you know, whenever. I mean, all the time, really. The twins. I retired in 2004. My principal wanted me to go another year, and I retired because I wanted to spend time with the twins. And so we're extremely involved with our families. If one of us were male, we would be the ideal couple for those crazies out there who think that somehow we don't deserve what they have. And I think that can be said about a lot of the people that I know. So that would be one thing. Giving me the same rights that other people have. And I was married. I was married to a man. You know, that's where I got my boys. I didn't find them out under a cabbage leaf in the garden. But giving me the same rights that I had then it doesn't take anything away from anybody else's marriage. It adds to the strength of our culture. So, I don't know. I'll think more about that. But those are the two things that come to mind.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with those statements. Do you think that Gay and Gray will help to keep elderly gay people out of the closet?
Keep them out?
Out of the closet, yeah.
I hope. Mm-hmm. That's certainly one of the goals, because it's so common with people going to nursing homes for them to feel like they have to go back in the closet. There's a lot of bias. You know, people in nursing homes are my age and older. My mom and dad, when they moved to Phoenix, they moved to a suburb of Phoenix that's a retirement community, and it's not, everybody has their own home. It's not an assisted living anything. I mean, people buy houses there, and there's a golf course, but you have to be 50 to live there. So it was all old white people, you know, very, very little racial diversity in the middle of Arizona with lots of brown people running around, but you hardly ever saw any of them there. And all heterosexual, mostly. But I knew from a friend of mine who had friends who lived there that there were actually some gay people there in this little Sun Lakes community. And I remember my dad saying, we were over at this little restaurant there at the golf course one time, and there were these two women sitting over there, and he said, those are the Jones sisters. And I looked over and I said, they're not sisters. Oh, well, yeah, they are. They're both last names Jones. I said, that's what they're saying, but they're not sisters. But they're sisters. He said, really? So, how did I... Oh, so the closet thing. Here's the thing. I mean, you do it because people go back in the closet for reasons of safety. I mean, it's been well documented that if you come out in a nursing home that's not progressive, you know, the answer, the lights more slowly. And a lot of times, we used to show this video, and I haven't showed it much recently, but it comes out of Colorado called, I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Excuse me. But anyway, in the video, they interview a couple of nursing home managers. And one of them says, you know, the issue is not the staff. I believe that if someone were out of the closet or if a couple came in and took up residence in our home, that it wouldn't be the staff. The staff would treat them well. It's the other residents. That's what it was in high school. When I was working in the high school environment, the whole staff knew I was a lesbian. They'd all met my partner. She'd gone to all the social events and parties with me. So that was not an issue. There might have been a couple for whom it was an issue, but I was pretty well liked and I had good rapport with the staff. So it really was not an issue. And for me, it was a gradual process of coming out. I mean, when I started coming out when my partner got diagnosed with breast cancer in 1995. And I had to go to my principal and talk to her. And I said, well, you know, I need to talk to you. First of all, I have to tell you I'm gay. She said, well, I already knew that. What's the problem? So somebody else had told her, you know. So that started my gradual process. And basically what I wanted to talk to her about was the fact that April was going to have surgery, and I didn't know what the aftermath of all this was going to be. I didn't know what they were going to find, what treatment we were going to be facing, that sort of thing. And she said, you just take the time you need, whatever you need, you just let me know. So that was the kind of support I consistently got from her as my principal, but also from the rest of the staff. The problem was the kids. You can't, if you're a high school teacher in this day and age, unless you work for Portland Public Schools, which is much more progressive, you can't safely come out to the students because you're going to have some parent breathing down your neck and standing on the principal's desk protesting. You know, we saw that in Beaverton a couple of years ago, but I will say to their credit, they've really tried hard to rectify that. And we have presented at their diversity conference the last two or three years in a row, and they're making an effort to try to rectify that. So it's the loss of regard. There are kids, and I always had great rapport with students, and there are kids who, there are probably kids who knew, who suspected. Gay kids probably knew. And in fact, I had a kid come back one time and say, why couldn't they let you tell us so that we would have you as a role model, so we would know, you know, that we too could have a successful life, etc. But there are other kids that I think it would have negatively impacted, you know, their view of me and impacted my relationship with them. Now, maybe that would have been an okay price to pay, but at that point I wasn't sure enough that the administration on up might not have gone after me. So that's the thing, you know, with nursing home. You have to worry about the people that you live with and go to dinner with and lunch with and all those things every day, how they're going to treat you, even if the staff's being nice. So.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about how the community has changed about gay issues. Mm-hmm. What changes have you seen, good and bad, in the gay community itself?
Over the years?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I came out in Omaha, Nebraska, in the mid-70s, it was all about the bar scene. I mean, everybody went to the bars and hung out in the bars all the time, and I was still drinking then, so that suited me just fine. Because my partner and I don't drink anymore, we are not, you know, maybe a function of that, it might be a function of the fact that we're older, the bar scene means nothing to us anymore. It just might be that our lives are much, much different because of our age and our sobriety. But I also know that there's no, you know, I don't think there is as big a bar scene as there used to be. Now, that might not be true. I might just be making that up, and I might not be right about that. But I think that there is less tendency to stereotype one another in the gay community than there used to be. I mean, in the 70s, you know, we were expected, even within the community, to fit into a certain stereotype. I remember, God, in the 70s, lesbians were almost expected to be man-haters. And it was like, what the heck? I have two sons. I have a dad that I adore. I mean, you know what I mean? But there was this sort of expectation that there were certain lines, you know, based on gender within the community itself. And, you know, what else would I say? I don't think drinking is maybe... I think there are other ways for people to get together and meet one another now without having to go to bars. Back then, that was kind of the only place you could go. We have other options now. So that's one thing. Well, the gym, if nothing else, apparently is the place. We didn't have gyms in the 70s. Now we have 24-hour fitness where you can meet people if you want to. And online. I mean, there was no online. There was no internet then. And so apparently that's also an option. I've been with my partner so long, I don't have to think about that, thank God. But, you know, what are other changes in the gay community? I think that we accept each other more for who we are, and all our diversity within the community, including people who are transgendered. And nobody talked about tranny issues back then. Nobody talked about being a bisexual, my God, you know. And everybody was gay, and I still think of myself as gay because that was the big umbrella term. And I knew a lot of women who didn't like the word lesbian because it felt like a label. Well, whatever. So, you know, I think we've moved past a lot of that. And I think that's probably a good thing. I think we're more accepting.
Was there a division between gay men and lesbian women?
Probably, although I always had a lot of gay male friends. One of my best friends in the world is a guy that I taught with in Nebraska. He's retired now, too, but all the students thought we were having an affair. And when he came on in the faculty, I was already teaching there. He was, probably 6 or so years younger than I am. And, April?
Yeah.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
This is my partner. This is Marcus and Adrian.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Hi, Adrian.
We're doing our little interview here.
Okay, I won't get in my house.
Are you going anywhere now?
I'm just waiting here from the dentist.
Okay.
So,
all right.
I could be doctored at any moment.
Okay. So when he came on at the school, I knew, you know, I took one look at him and was like, oh, okay. Well, we ran into each other at the bar and we were both freaked out. It was like, now he knew and I knew and we both knew about each other and we were both like, oh my God, oh no, no, don't. Well, it's like, duh, it occurred to us that we were there for the same reason, so we became fast friends, still are. And he's been with his partner even longer than April and I've been together. I've always had good friends in the gay male community. That sort of cuts through a lot of those stereotypes and those divisions also. Back in the late 70s, when the big recovery movement, and I'm talking about now as a larger phenomenon, not just in our community, but it was really getting off the ground, the gay meetings were not welcome at the Alamo Club here in Portland. And the Alamo Club is a big house up in Northwest, and someone sometime along the way, I think, must have given this big house to somebody, and that's its sole function. It's a big, gorgeous home with white pillars and stuff, and it's just AA meetings there all the time. Anyway, there were gay meetings back there in the late 70s, and they asked them to leave, and so they founded the Live and Let Live Club, which was where the gay meetings met. And it was really necessary. When I got sober in 1982, the Live and Let Live Club, which is, it's moved around a lot of places since then, but it was just down the street at 27th and Belmont, so I could easily walk down. And it was great because you could go there and be who you are. And that wasn't true in other meetings around the city. Well, that's all changed. The Live and Let Live Club is finally closing its doors this spring, I think at the end of March. It's had financial difficulties for some time, but there also really isn't a need for it much anymore. Gay meetings are, you know, first of all, one of our home groups is a women's meeting downtown Portland, and I would say it's about 60% straight and 40% lesbians, and it's one of the most wonderful, accepting meetings I've ever been to. And there's lots of meetings around town that I have been to where there are other gay people and they're open about it and nobody cares. But that wasn't true 30 years ago. So, you know, so things have changed a lot. When we were all going to the gay meetings, though, we were all in there together, the men and the women, and we had to be okay with each other. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it was a struggle. I was on the board of directors down there for 3 years, and sometimes the men and women could go, you know, head to toe about how things were going to be. And I can remember some of those fights, and some of the men, I thought, well, you're just so prissy about it. You know, I'm sure that they thought I was just this big pushy dyke, you know. But mostly we had to figure it out, you know. And I've always, like I said, I've always had good gay male friends. It's mm-hmm. good.
Yeah. So, what have you enjoyed most about living in Portland?
Oh, everything. I love Portland. It's a fabulous place to live. For one thing, it's very progressive politically. And it's, you know, it's the only thing that keeps Oregon as a blue state, really. So I really like that. And Southeast Portland, this area of Southeast Portland was really, well, I bought my house here in the early 80s. It was sometimes called the lesbian ghetto. I mean, it was really, what is now Zupan's up there used to be an actual dairy, and the dairy trucks would rumble up and down the street. And it was really kind of on the underneath side of middle class. Now, of course, it's one of the hip places to live in Portland. And I've been here a long, long time, obviously. You know, I like the politics of the city. It doesn't mean I agree with everybody about everything, but I just like the environment here. I like the physical environment. When I first came to Oregon, I really thought it was spectacular, and I still feel that way. We have everything here, you know. You can be on Mount Hood in an hour or so. You can be at the beach in a little more than an hour. The Columbia Gorge is, I mean, it's just all of it. It's just a great place to live. Everything.
So I'll just finish with this question. What do you think could change the public's perception of the elderly gay community? And do you think that it could change?
Well, I think that there's probably two pieces involved in that. One has to do with people's opinion of gay people. And then there's how do people see old people? And so then in gay elders, you have the two things juxtaposed. But I mean, in our culture, you know, we're funny about old people. Like, there are other cultures who honor their elders. Native Americans, for example, honor their elders more than some Americans do, you know. What could change? Oh my God, Marcus. I just think that what you have is a culture that is sort of youth-obsessed. And that's, to some extent, that's been true of the gay community, especially with gay men, but lesbians as well. I mean, I went through a period when I was in my, you know, middle ages, the 40s and stuff, where, you know, it was easy for me to date younger women because I was older and more stable and this kind of thing. But then you get to a certain age where that's not so true anymore. And I think with gay men, youth and good looks have been especially, you know, a premium, so to speak. But I think the culture at large is that way. I mean, you can hear actresses, and I read an interview with, say, Meryl Streep, for example, where she thought when she turned a certain age, 50 or 55, that her career was over. So I think it permeates our culture. It's not just gay people. I think that we are youth-obsessed. We are body image-obsessed, looks-obsessed. We're very materialistic kind of culture, and I think that leaks over into our whole thing about age and stuff. And then when you add the layer of, you know, gayness to it, it makes it even harder. So
what do you think would change, like, the public's perception?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to that question about what would I want people to know about us. Mm-hmm. I know that for me, and it's not probably entirely unlike what African Americans experience. So you always have to do it better you know, you have to be better at it, you have to do more of it, you have to be more perfect, you can't make mistakes, because everybody sees you as sort of a, you know, a representative of your community. You know, you represent all Black people or all gay people or whatever it is. And so, you know, I do keep that in mind, that I, you know, I live a sober life, I lead a very law-abiding life, a very honest life with lots of integrity, blah, 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 blah. But, and I do that because it's who I am, but I also am mindful of the fact that it might impact how somebody sees my community. You know how it is, you see an article about somebody in the paper, and it, you know, somebody does something bad and it turns out that he's Hispanic, or he's Black, or, you know, he's Iranian, or, oh, well, see, of course, you know, or some, you know what I mean? So, what was it? I read something, somebody did something a while back, and I thought, oh, great, give all gay people a bad name, and I can't even remember who it was, somebody, you know, these congressmen that are always, like, dallying around with members of the same sex, and then, you know, but they have their wives at home. It's like, come on. Mm-hmm. You make us all look bad. So it's pretty complicated. I think it's really about a shift and knowing that gay people are like everybody else, and we just want all the same things everybody else wants. Mm-hmm. Is that it?
That is all.